You hear that?
Get down in the car. One time, give it all. Bust it open, huh? Let me see your job.
What's going on, everybody? It is Wednesday night. It is 10 p.m. It's time for the Ivy League Hood Rats. Yo, we're back. The duo is back. As we are, I'm going to tell you right now, go ahead and start sharing this link. You know, go get your water. Go get your adult beverage, whatever it is. As before we start here, I want to go ahead and do my thing where I make sure that all the links are working right. So I'm going to do that real quick. So let's look at YouTube right now. YouTube. Are we on live on YouTube? Yes, we are. We're on YouTube right now. Let's go ahead and go to LinkedIn. Let's see what's going on LinkedIn. And yes, we are on LinkedIn. Now, Facebook, please. Facebook, you all be stressing me out. Let's see. Facebook, are we live on Facebook? I got to keep scrolling down until I see that box. Are we there? Come on, Facebook. Why you guys do this to me all the time? But you know what, though? Let's go to Twitter first. Let's go to Twitter. Again, good evening, everybody. It is Wednesday night. It's 10 p.m. It's midweek. And hopefully it's been a good week for all of y'all out there. You know how it is for those of us working people. It's nonstop, you know. So we want to make sure that I want to make sure you guys are good. And with that, let's go ahead and start the show. The only place I don't know if we're on right now is Facebook. So I'm going to troubleshoot Facebook while we do introductions. And with that being said, good evening, everyone. One more time. I'm here. This is Uche Njoku, Sneaky Principal. I'm here with my brother, Archie Tyson. Archie, the mic is yours. Talk to the people.
I'm just out here. It's another Friday, man. I'm jumping the gun. It's a Wednesday, so you know we're gonna talk about a few things.
Yo, we missed you last week. We missed you last week. I got a couple of comments. People were like, "Yo, where Arch at?"
So my wife drugged me down to Jamaica to one of her friend's wedding. I mean, I went kicking it.
You got dragged to Jamaica.
Yeah, okay. I got dragged to Jamaica. I mean, kicking and screaming, get on the plane. Just that warm breeze out there on the beach and the curry goat and the jerk pork. No disrespect to my brothers and sisters that are off the pig, but ooh, that jerk pork was delicious. Oh my God, it was delicious.
I can only imagine.
So I got a little past my limit of inebriation, as they say, past the limit where one should be speaking to anyone. And, I missed the show. So my apologies, folks. I will try and make up this week. But I did enjoy Jamaica on everyone's behalf for them. So just note, I missed the show for a good reason. We all need wellness. Yeah. We have to relax. We have to renew. So we all need that.
And that's facts right there, honestly. You know, the thing right now is that often we're so overworked and just over pushing. You know, we're not even overworked. We push ourselves too far sometimes. And the fact that, you know, that you're able to take a break, you know, go to Jamaica. Listen, last week I was living vicariously through you. So I'm looking forward to my trip next week. I'm heading out to not Jamaica. I'm heading out to Wichita, Kansas. I'm going to go see some family, see pops. But I think right about now, just getting out of the city is a good thing. So
you need to. I think over my aunt's house, if my cousins and crew were cooking and making smothered chicken out there. Shout out my aunt Dealey. She had a surgery and she's doing well. But I got people out there in Wichita too.
Okay. Listen, let them know I'm coming. Let them know baby boy's coming. You said smothered chicken. That's all I had to hear.
They're not gonna feed you as much when you had a little more weight on you. You know, I remember you took me to the what was the name of that African restaurant? West African restaurant up in the Bronx. The skinny dude.
Is it still there? It's even still there.
I don't know.
Jerome Avenue. Jerome Avenue. It was a Ghanaian place.
Yeah, all the way up. Oh my God. Oh my God. Auntie, like, cooked us. Yeah. Yeah. They enjoy feeding me.
This is one thing about Africans, man. If you walk into a restaurant or walk in somebody's house and you're over 200 pounds like we are, it's like a blessing. But they're like, yo, I get to test all my cuisines on you. You know?
All the cuisine. And I'm like, I want all the smoke. I want all, if you can cook, now, you know, for all my ladies and gentlemen out there that are not, that can't burn, it's okay. I'm sure you're good at other things. You can take a cooking class and you can, you know, get better. But for my people that can actually just straight throw down, I want all the smoke, right? So yeah, I appreciate it.
It's African culture, you know, and it's rooted in African culture. The one thing I remember, I was told when I was a kid, it was like, yo, you might be poor, but you will not go hungry. That's at the core of African culture. So if you're not gonna go hungry, it's not gonna be garbage food. It's gonna be food that's gonna sustain you. So you're right. What you about to say?
What's so crazy is folks don't know that right now, like, we're just like directly connecting like culture pieces of West African culture and South African culture.
No, fam. We're not connected. We're revealing the connection.
We're revealing the connection. In some people's brain, it ought to be a connection. But yeah, we're definitely revealing the connection because like these things are just very rooted in the culture that Black folks in America had to kind of build out of what had been stripped from them, but it's interesting how so many aspects just still show up just as clear as day over time. And that whole sharing a meal, what did Dr. Maya Angelou say, this famous video, right, when she talks about people would come to her brownstone in Harlem where she would prepare meal and sit around and talk and laugh and drink. And, you know, she talks about nothing more intimate than preparing a meal and enjoying it with family and friends. And just thinking about that being so deeply connected, just it's amazing how many traditions what traditions survived. And then that also makes me think in horror of the things that were stripped from folks, you know.
Let me ask you a question. You broke Maya Angelou and her cooking in Harlem, inviting people. I can only imagine who was in those rooms. You know, we're talking about poets and writers and politicians and maybe even the homeless man down the block. You know,
right? That's what I'm saying. You're saying great, all these esteemed and astute people, but not the Maya Angelou's from Stamps, Arkansas. She was from small town Pissot, Arkansas. So regular people, she enjoyed, you know, all the, you know, she would enjoy me when I sit up and start speaking in this way and presenting and projecting in this way. And she would just enjoy me when I'm like, oh my God, that chicken was, that fried chicken was right. She would enjoy either way, right? Yeah. So it wasn't just the stoop people. So, you know, country folks can't help it.
I remember in college, when I would get homesick, what I would miss is the food. But the thing is, I'm the oldest of five, so my mom taught me how to cook really early. And what I was really homesick about was cooking for my family. So I remember in college, I would go through my moments, and I would just go. And luckily, there was an African shop across the bridge from University of Rochester. And it was walking distance. I would go there, get my stockfish, get my ingredients and my oxtail, come back to the house. And not the house, the dorm room. We had a little kitchenette. And I started chefing. And it was, I'll be honest with you, it was just brothers invited. You know what I'm saying? Because it was like, yo, get the fellas through, come through. And it's funny thinking back to who was in that room at that time, you know? And right now, I there was one of the brothers in that room who would come through on Saturdays or Sundays to eat. He's now the mayor of Rochester. Then another one became a naval officer. Another one is a state health inspector for New York State. Another one became a writer at Forbes magazine. But yo, we were a bunch of black, broke, you know, hood rats, just sitting in my door, in my suite, just eating oxtail and talking shit. Sometimes we were drinking a little something, sometimes we were doing some other stuff, but it was just us, you know? And to now fast forward, these are very successful, powerful men. But that space of gathering where we got to be together and just build in brotherhood, you know? And it's sad because I feel like we don't get to do that as much these days anymore. You know, yeah. We get success and we kind of like confine ourselves into our family units rather than our villages.
We don't want anyone to ask us to do anything, and you know, we don't want to be we get locked away and we forget that, like, what's more beautiful than a good dinner party? Not one where everyone's stuck on their phone and trying to tell, but like a good, beautiful dinner party where you sit around and tell stories. Now, I'll say this, I'm from Memphis. We are all about in Mississippi, the oral traditions and just storytelling. But I've said this, and my wife is from the Bronx. Don't nobody tell a story like a good New York dude, a good hood New York dude on a corner. I'm talking about the one that got the rag under the hat in the summertime, the one that know it's a certain time of year where he switched over from Timbo's to
got his hat cut down like this, like your fam. Let me tell you something.
They got a hat. Right. When he started telling the story, son, let me tell, and clapping it. Yo, it is a thing of beauty, and people don't appreciate the art of storytelling, but if you never had like a real line a hood New York dude like over your house and y'all get to telling like a story and he's in the element, like, yo, it's a thing of beauty to me. And I'm from down south, but, for story,
but bro, I'll argue about the down south. When I was in the Marine Corps and I was in South Carolina and I was in North Carolina, yo, these brothers, they start telling stories, and that voice get high pitch, and you're not sure if they're telling the truth or lying, but you just be hooked in like, yo, for real, that happened? That happened? And then it'll be, the story will go from like, it was five of us to like, it was 20 of us. You be like, what's going on here? But again, making those connections to African culture. As a child, I learned to communicate sitting at the footstool of my uncles and my grandfather. And listen to them talk to each other and telling stories. Some of the stories were hybrid of fiction, facts, historical context, fantasy. But you learn how to tell stories because at the end of the day, that's how we men, as men, we bond. Think about it. You're not going to be somebody who tells you a good story and you're not going to be like, yo, I fuck with you. You
know? Oh, man, a good story will just carry you, right? A good story, like just... Just that, again, this is a tradition of just storytelling, but dudes, it's imperative. Like, if you meeting up for sport, or we just around a grill, or but like being able to tell stories, football glory stories, strip club stories, being able to, whatever kind of story. I don't care if it's your wedding story, your game story, like. Yeah, it's important, and I think people don't realize that as an art form, because it is. I mean, that's all rap and hip-hop and poetry is doing, is telling a story, but just people don't think about the great, like, oral traditions that are in urban areas, and just when they tell a story, it's literally, I can imagine you sitting around your uncles, and they're telling a story. Hell, that was the movies. Right. That was the movie.
That was the movie.
They can tell a story so good that you can see it happening. Right. It's like, you know, we were both teachers at one point in time, even though I taught math but later on I taught U.S. history. But I'm like, I never taught ELA. I had to say that. So don't ask me to teach kids how to read. I teach them how to add. Calculate, tell me why P of 4 is equal to 5. We can work on that. We're not going to work on it. You know, some of the other reading stuff, but I do know storytelling.
But you know, it's funny though, what you just said right now, because most teachers will say, I'm not a math person, you know, and I'm always like, yeah, I'll read your paper for you, you know, don't, and I will catch context issues, but don't ask me about grammar because half the time I can't spell for shit. You know, but it's interesting how most teachers will tell you I'm not a math person. But for me, my comfort zone is math and science because to me it's very exact. You know, there's nothing lost in translation. H2O is still H2O, you know. But, you know, ask me to do MLA or APA, I'm going to go on Google and get that generated to do it for me.
Yeah, they got EndNote and Zotero, all that stuff that'll get it for you these days. but no, I just think that, you know, it's a sit around the campfire, you know, sit around the fire, sit around the grill and be able to share and make people literally see mind movies. I think that's what I was thinking about with elementary school teachers when they are reading to students and students are starting to read. You know, you want to develop to be able to see mind movies, right, when you're reading a book. But just think about it, that's reading a book. With someone telling a story, you don't even have the words in front of you, but you have to listen and you're really tuned in. You start to see the movie. It's a beautiful art form that, you know, is really unappreciated. And if it's really unappreciated in general, I know it's unappreciated in black spaces, whether rural, whether urban, both of us probably sitting outside the suburbs right now. Shout out to all my black people that's in the suburbs. Don't y'all be ashamed to be living in the suburbs. Enjoy watching your grass grow and the boredom and stuff that you have. So shout out to all you all. Just make sure that, you know, bring better fried chicken places to the suburbs. That's all I'm saying.
We deserve fried chicken too. Yeah, that's very true. Down the block, that's just suspect over here in
New Rochelle. Yeah. So
you walk by, it smells good. And you walk in, but like, what is that?
I took this totally off topic. You know, Don't ADHD does that for you, but. I just think that it's not appreciated in our spaces, barbershops and beauty shops and nail salons and street corners and arcades, hell, classrooms, locker rooms. Like, storytelling is amazing when you have folks that can, you know, really lock it in.
What about on the bus? Okay, I know you agree with this. What about storytelling on the bus? Going to a football game or come back from a football game on a team bus.
That's the best.
And when they stop playing dozens, your mama jokes.
Oh, when you have that, listen. So some places call it roasting, some call it blazing, some people call it the dozen. In Memphis, we call it checking. You know, everybody know we busting jokes. It's some these days they call it bullying. What? And back in the day, you used to have somebody in your crew that was specifically there. They couldn't fight. They bust jokes because you wanted somebody that could bust jokes on everybody else that was your ops or opposition, as these new children will say. You had fighters, but this person was a fighter. They bust jokes, right? Because checking, roasting, blazing, playing, it meant that much to us. And I can remember one of the best and most fondest memories I have in school is when two legendary checkers finally met on a school bus going on a field trip. And they met on the same bus for 40 minutes. It was the best comedy show. And we didn't have camera phones. We didn't have camcorders. We went to school in the hood. We had no way to document this other than you had to be there. It was Spot. And Spot had, you know, whatever the condition where black people have lighter patches on their face. Now, Spot had it all over. So everybody in the hood called him Spot. That's, you know, I don't know. Spot might be alive. Spot might not be alive. Memphis is crazy. You do crazy stuff in Memphis. And, you know,
the nicknames.
I forget the other cat name. It was the Beaver. One of them had the Beaver teeth before. Those two guys provided one of the best live entertainment sessions. The bus driver almost wrecked the bus because they were laughing so hard. I mean, it was a thing of beauty, right? And it was nothing wrong. It was a part of our community. It's our thing. We held it dearly, and now we've gotten so high and mighty that our thing is now bullying.
Yeah, you get suspended for it.
Because you found me a fat, bald-headed dude, fat back, bald-headed dude with a beard, and I am indeed a fat, black, bald-headed dude with a beard.
So I know right now there's people listening who are saying, oh, no, it's not funny. That's traumatic and X, Y, Z. And I think what's traumatic is your inability to handle yourself in situations where it might be stressful or people might be coming at you as an adult. Because if you grew up in a certain era as a kid, and listen, I came here in the 80s from Africa, and I sounded like this. And there wasn't any other children like me. So guess what? Bro, I got all the jokes. And at first, I was mad. I was trying to fight people. Then I was like, I could fight y'all.
I
could become Michael Blackson.
I was going to say, tell them what jokes, but I'm like, no, let's not go down that path.
I mean, it was dumb. It was dumb jokes. But the thing was, I appreciate that time because it allowed me, because once I started to see, it wasn't just about me. Anybody could get it. Like, literally, could get it. The teacher could get it. The principal could get it.
Principal could get it. Police could get it. They come into school.
It was jokes. And the great thing about it is once I released and realized this is just a cultural thing, and I also remembered, because for me, being a foreigner in a foreign land, I thought it was about me, but then, and I forgot, back in Nigeria, we do the exact same thing. When we start talking about your head, your feet, your face, and how are you big, and how the jokes keep coming, you know? And it's just part of the culture. It's a cultural thing, but what it also does is it helps you build a tougher skin and laugh at yourself, you know? So, but I think it's sad that now, because especially you said pure comedy, 14 minutes. You're literally on that bus, 14 minutes. You watched literally something that people will pay for on stage at the Apollo at the Madison Square Garden. But now it's bullying. So those kids who have that talent are completely blocked off. The talent is completely blocked. So you never, the next Kevin Hart or Dave Chappelle could be on those buses. But now it's punishable by suspension or even expulsion. For cracking jokes.
Not only are they persecuted, but everyone that would love to see the shows. Now, let me say this. There's something that is real life bullying, right? And what did you say? Some people are going to say like, oh, this is hard and traumatic. Now, I'm going to say something that's controversial.
Here we go.
I'm so sick of snivelly, whiny weaklings hollering out that everything is traumatic. Need I remind many black people in this country, if your family is like my family, your great-grandmothers worked in fields, your great-grandfathers worked in fields, or work for free and then were exploited. So if you telling me that you're trying to equate, and I don't want to play the oppression Olympics, but my grandmother's experience of working in a cotton field in Mississippi from can't see to can't see early in the morning to can't see at night, snakes, scorpions, lilies, mosquitoes, and all that other stuff. If you're trying to equate that traumatic experience with a few jokes on the bus, you're nuts, right? If you're I know traumatic experiences. Seeing somebody head get halfway blown off outside of your high school, traumatic experience. Being handcuffed by a police officer and getting sitting on the curb for nothing. And asking why you handcuffed and getting punched by a full grown man and you're a boy, traumatic experience. Kids that there are real live traumatic experiences, But everything that everyone's claiming as traumatic, and I know there are nuances and around neurotypicalness, and I know some people say the science, but we have to stop labeling everything with that broad brush and making it taboo and equating it to something else. And I mean, that's the same thing I say, Kevin Hart, they kicked him out for the Oscars. Well, he wasn't supposed to be hosting the Oscars because he was anti-LGBTQ plus. No, he made jokes. Stupid. It may be distasteful in this era, but it was jokes. And
not that's even an recent, art though. Form. It wasn't even recent.
But not even recent. He made jokes. And for that reason, something was stripped from him. And he made I agree with him. Y'all calling me anti this. No, I know real homophobic people. I'm not homophobic. We all know real homophobic people. Yeah. Many of them are our uncles, daddies, and granddaddies, and grandma.
You said were?
I said are.
It meant are. Many of them are.
We go to barbershops and churches and good. Mm-hmm. We know real life homophobic people. That have done bad things and said bad things with intent to harm to people in that community. But to equate him trying to make some people laugh on a Friday, making fun of something, to real live people that have committed harm or had the intent to commit harm is just utterly foolish. And you should stop. So if that's controversial, you know, c'est la vie. Everybody, that's me. Unapologetically.
I got a question for you, bro. Since this conversation naturally took us towards comics and comedians. So yes, I probably will be canceled for asking this question, just for even asking the question. Okay. So let's talk about Dave Chappelle. And I'll take full ownership of bringing this topic up. So, right. The SNL situation from like two or three weeks ago, and yeah. Everybody went crazy, and not everybody, but certain people were like, "Oh my God, it was so anti-Semitic. He was this, he was that." I was confused about that because I was like, I've watched comedians of all races who have just blatantly come out and just been like flippant in their comments. But in this situation, after all that was happening with Kyrie and with Kanye, he did a set that I felt was an attempt to lighten the mood, but also to bring perspective. And the fact that it went from now he's anti-Semitic or what he did was not funny, but I'm like, but wait a minute, but I watch a lot of comedy. I've watched comedians of all races say some crazy things and no one has ever pointed out to the Asian comic or the Indian comic or the white comic for saying things that were off color. But in this case, now it seems like who's being attacked consistently are black comics. You know, and I'm like, what's going on here? And I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what is your thought about that? What did he do that was wrong? Maybe I'm missing something.
All right, so I'm gonna swing back to that black comic attack. I think Lee said it in the chat that this generation is very sensitive, and that is right up my alley. The level of sensitivity and grit and all that, I have no idea where it went. Now, attacking black comics is attacking an art form and a form of allowing us to release. I started tonight by kind of we're talking about something before and that racist Oklahoma incident, where it was so painful that you just, some stuff is so racist, so terrible, so painful, so distasteful, and just crazy that you just gotta, it's an age old tactic of black people. We laugh, we joke about it to keep from crying. Facts. It's easy for us to process it in jokes than to actually process it in other realms. And if we can get up here and hear these jokes and tell these jokes and laugh about it, we cannot cry ourselves into an early stressful grave, because this, we know what we're up against. So attacking black comics and trying to water down that mechanism that allows people to get some of this stuff out without going crazy, because you'd be surprised. To quote one of my classmates at Columbia, poverty be making people crazy. He's a principal in the South Bronx. Poverty be making people crazy. Don't push me. I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a dunk. People are close. All these doggone mass shootings and all this stuff going on, people are on the edge. And taking away some of that release, I think, can be intentional, right? And I do think also it's sensitivity, and some of it is self-inflicting wounds. Are black folks too sensitive? Our LGBT plus community too sensitive? Sometimes I land, but people are too sensitive. Lighten up. Some stuff is true. You know, it ain't. Some stuff is true. Some stuff you just need to take a quick laugh, right? And then I think that everything is anti-Semitic. Again, that level of sensitivity, the bar for the level of sensitivity of what is anti-Semitic is so high that you literally, as Dave Chappelle said, you can't say anything because it's going to be labeled or branded as anti-Semitic. I mean, you can't make any comment. No laughing ones. No joking ones, even if it's the truest thing on the planet, and it's not a gross stereotype that causes harm. Even if it's something is true, a generalization that's documented through research, you dare not say it because it will be labeled as anti-Semitic. Now, keep in mind, if we Google the Oxford, and I'm about to do it now, Google the Oxford definition for Semitic. Let's see what Oxford Dictionary actually says.
And for those of you who watch my other podcast, so you know what I would say wasn't cap. He's about to. I did the exact same thing a couple weeks ago. So you're not saying that Uche is out here making stories up. So please share with us what Semitic is. You know, and it's funny because there's so many people who want to kind of like to redirect the truth of what these terms mean and who these people are, you know, and it's so interesting because, again, based on the definition that my brother here is about to pull up, when Kyrie said, "I know who I am," it wasn't him making stories up. You know, this is actually historically, academically proven facts that we just, you know, we don't talk about.
So this is the Oxford Learner Dictionary. I don't want the Oxford Learner's Dictionary. I want the Oxford Standard English one.
But while Archie's pulling this up, so a couple of things to note about Semitic. It has two references. One having to do with Shem, who was one of the sons of Noah, and the other has to do with language, Afro-Asiatic mm-hmm. languages from North Africa. So
the Oxford reference says, relating to or denoting a family of languages that include Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, which is the language of Jesus, mm-hmm. right? Everybody knows that's the language of Christ.
What they spoke during that time, yeah.
Was Aramaic and not Hebrew. But Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, and certain ancient languages such as Phoenician, Arcadian, constituting the main subgroup of Afro-Asiatic family. Okay. The actual Oxford Learner's Dictionary says of or connected with the language group that includes Hebrew and Arabic, of or connected with the people who speak Semitic languages, especially Hebrew and Arabic. So, you know, I don't know how is this, I don't know how, I understand that America in general, never has there been a country where the mildly educated is so high and the highly educated is so low.
So low, yeah.
Because everyone in this country essentially has access to basic education, K-12. Now, whether you just choose to utilize that, that's on you, right? Or your family or whatever, and circumstances, of
but
course.
But bro, I mean, like you said, everyone has access to. But what do they really have access to, depending on who is leading that school and where that school is located and who is in that school?
I'm not suggesting quality. I'm just saying every state, every entity has free public schools. The schools might be terrible, but there are buildings. There's some learning that may be occurring in those buildings. That's you not a guarantee in most other
countries. At least be able to read and reason.
Right. That's not a guarantee in countries. Like, you don't go to K-12 in a lot of countries, right? So, but considering that our university system is the envy of the world, because all 50 states have a public university system, then private universities, liberal arts colleges, all of them, we ain't even got to these, you know, new Stevensons and all this kind of can on. But it's the envy of the world, but a relatively low number of us have, and I say of us, I mean just Americans in general. I ain't talking about just black Americans, because I think black women are the most educated segment of the population anyhow, at least now they are, of any subgroup. But so many, there's so few as it relates to the population that actually have advanced degrees. So everyone has some, there's such a high number of people that have a mild level of education, but the number of people that actually have advanced degrees is low considering the freebies that everyone have in relation to other countries that some other countries that have just a tremendous literacy rate. So I can believe, you know, that we don't, I don't know. It's an interesting concept to think about.
One of the things that that I've been battling with. So I've been like I've shared this with listeners, and I've shared it with you too, Archie. I've been spending a lot of time just digging, trying to get a better understanding. Because I'll be honest with you, at first I thought I knew. I was like, I'm Igbo, Nigeria, southeastern Nigeria, and I thought that was the end of the story. And now I know it's not the end of the story. It's just the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 weeks ago I went down to Philadelphia to spend some time with my uncle, who's he's actually my my great cousin. I don't even know how to do it. He's my father's first cousin, and he holds a lot of the stories, a lot of the old traditions of our family. He mm-hmm. has. So I went down there and I was like, I took my son with me, you know, because it was his first time seeing my son, and our culture is very, very important because it is a patriarchal culture, and even though women have a high esteem in the community and they're property owners and they have power, but the bloodline is passed through the son. So my son is the oldest grandson, you know, and I'm the oldest. He's the oldest of his generation, firstborn of the first son. So my father was the first son. So I went to go see him, and we were sitting there, and I was asking him, like, all this stuff with Kyrie and all these different things. And it's funny because I hadn't been in his house. I'd never been to his house. I've only seen him when he was in New York. When I walked into his house, the first thing that I saw when I walked into his house was the Star of David. So I was like, yo, unk, what's that about? You know, and I knew, but I didn't know. And he sat down with me. He told me, let me tell you the story of how we ended up where we are in southeastern Nigeria. And he told me the story of the migration of the sons of Eri, who was the grandson of Jacob, you know. And off the top of my head, if somebody knows whose son Eri was, but Eri was one of the sons, was the son of one of the 12 sons. So he was direct. So down to the point where the place that I'm from in Nigeria is called Oweri. The last three letters of the place is actually the name of the grand. And I'm like, and I don't ask, is this something that was created? He's like, no, it's always been that name. When we got there, it's what we named it. And he's like, all through Igbo land, Hebrew is embedded in our language. And he starts telling me these things, and I'm like, wait a minute, so that's a Hebrew word? And I'm looking it up. I'm like, oh, snap, it is. And we're talking about stuff that predates colonization, predates the first European stepping into, you know. Mm. And then, like you said, there's all this information out there that you can, at the tip of your fingers, you could type up and look up. But the way we're educated, and this is my problem, because I feel like I've been a perpetuator unknowingly of this, that we tell our students and our children that they have to to be labeled as educated, they have to fall in line with this Western perspective of education, which is absent of who we are, because it's completely absent of who we are, period. So here I am. Yeah. And it's crazy. And there's so much information. Not to take this conversation in the opposite direction. So check this out. You don't like this, because you're a history buff. So I came across a document. Somebody told me about this document from the Nixon Library, President Nixon's library. And it's a letter written, a top secret memo from Henry Kissinger. You know who Henry Kissinger was? Secretary of State under Nixon. And this was during the Biafra War, which is the civil war of Nigeria, where over 2 million Igbos were murdered, pretty much. You know, they were starved to death, and they were literally killed during the civil war. And this letter is from 1969, and the title of it is pretty much, what should we do? What should America do about this thing that's happening in West Africa, this war? And in there, I'm going to share with you, it breaks down who the parties are, what's happening, and it does a beautiful job. You know, the CIA don't play. They know everything, because most of the time, they're the ones who started it anyway, or they were somehow involved. So it has a breakdown who the parties are, what happened next, and everything else. Then it came into the descriptors. The Nigerian government, this is who they are, this is what they want, and this is what their beef is. Then Biafra, the country of Igbos, primarily Igbos who are trying to secede to create their own nation, this is who they are. In the letter, it says, and mind you, this is released in 2013, finally declassified. It says in there, the Igbos are the wandering Jews of Africa. And it went into detail about who they are and why they are being treated the way they're being treated. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I went to school in Nigeria, and I never heard this story before. I never heard that term. I've heard the term as being derogatory towards Igbos, as the Jews of Africa. But here it is in an official document from the Secretary of State to the United States President, saying here's a debrief of what's happening and who the parties are. And I'm thinking to myself, like, this is crazy. And I showed this letter to my uncle. My uncle was like, yeah, that's true. He's like, I've never seen this before, but this is true. We've always known this. And I'm asking him, like, how come you guys didn't teach us this? Your children, your grandchildren, how come you haven't taught us this? And I couldn't really get an answer from him about that. But I also understand in Nigeria, after that civil war, they were like, listen, we almost got annihilated. They killed 2 million of us. There was a Holocaust in Africa that nobody talks about.
No one talks about it.
But if you go on the computer, you type it in, it's there. There's a movie called Half of the Yellow Sun with Chitwell Ejiofor and Thandie Newton starred in it about that story. But it was a very bleached story. So all the details that necessary was taken out.
It doesn't give the historic. They do a portrayal, but it doesn't really explain the why so much.
Yeah, it's crazy because at the end of the day, these are the things that I think that doesn't allow us as Pan Africans, Black people around this world, to really, really solidify under a unified banner of understanding who we are, you know, because that was completely stripped. And even now that there's inklings of it, it's so jacked up that we are telling ourselves that's a lie. You're just trying to be white. You're just trying to be this, you know. So people like Kyrie shares a little tweet, and he's completely annihilated.
Yeah. I mean, when Hunter writes history,
it becomes his story.
Right. The Hunter is writing about what happened in the lion hut. The Hunter is never going to say that the lion slayed 10 of his men before you were able to get off a lucky shot and kill it. You just going to tell your triumphant victory and over. So it's the Hunter's perspective. And I think it's big business and in the Hunter's best interest to keep it that way. As you said, like, knowledge is at everyone's fingertips. But to speak certain knowledge that's out there, that's known, that has always been passed along through oral traditions, is blasphemy and will, you know, get you canceled and get, you know, you stripped and clipped, like I said. It's taking it back to enslavement times. And it's true. Again, when you some people get upset with me when I challenge what did in was integration a mistake? Some people look at me and say, what? Well, I just say, run the numbers.
See, you're asking if it was a mistake. I'm asking whether or not it was intentional.
Well, the academic concept is interest convergence. Mm-hmm. And you talk to some really, really old, elder Black people that were around pre-integration, and they'll say, you know, when we were building our own communities, own churches, own schools, own stores, and, you know, they got burned down. Those communities got
Black Wall Street, yeah,
and burned down, and Black Wall Street wasn't the only one. You know, you got the whole Black towns that are flooded on. So, but then this integration opportunity comes along, and honestly, it's only because we want those Black dollars. So now,
trillions of dollars.
We spend all that money, trillions, in 2022 outside of the Black community. We don't have any grocery stores. We barely have grocery stores or business. So we spend all that money outside of our community. And when you run the numbers on unemployment, imprisonment, teenage pregnancy, out of wedlock births, housing, wealth gap, education level. When you run the numbers, we're actually worse off. It just appears that we are doing relatively well because there are more of us that may have been peppered in the suburbs. But when you run the actual numbers, and I know what some people are saying, there are lies, damn lies, and then statistics. Give me that good Mark Twain quote to get the day going. Samuel Clemens to get the evening going. But when you run the numbers, it kind of speaks to, again, we say why Dr. King really was assassinated, because he started seeing things Brother Malcolm's way towards the end of his life and started thinking about human rights and poverty and all that stuff. So we'll give you this integration thing because we need all of your dollars. And now every wealthy black person, poor black person can't wait to go throw money away outside of their community because we haven't invested in our communities in that way, but it's intentional. So did integration help us out educationally? Sure it did. Did it also destroy us educationally and culturally? Sure it did.
And this is the one in reflecting about what you just said right now. Prior to integration, and let's talk about education, you know, prior to integrating of schools and eliminating, you know, independent black schools, you know, regardless of even if they were public and they were publicly funded, prior to that happening, there were more middle class, wealthier black communities across this country who were fully independent. But think about it, to be self-sufficient, you have to have your own lawyers, you have to have your own doctors, you have to have, because you couldn't go anywhere else. You have to have your own grocery stores. So looking at Oklahoma, for example, and Black Wall Street, it was completely insular. People spent their money in their communities because if you had a toothache, you went to the dentist that was in your neighborhood who was who was black, but you couldn't go to the white dentist. Yeah, if you were going to give birth, it was going to be a black midwife. It was everything in your community. Where did all these people get educated? In these schools, they were run by black folk in their community. And not only that, the most prestigious job you could have back then was what? The teacher.
Teacher.
It was a teacher. In Africa, listen, in Africa, they don't admit it, but they love teachers because without a teacher, guess what happens? You don't have anybody else. You don't have the doctor. You don't have the lawyer. You don't have the engineer. The teacher is the one who starts that path. But now when that was taken away, and the other thing too was, I was asked this question, once you integrated schools, what happened to all the black teachers?
They were fired.
You know,
and they were branded as unqualified.
Unqualified.
Or uncertified. And union said that teachers, certificate, and we know that the teaching profession is what, 70% white and female?
80%.
80. Mm-hmm. So, 80%. So what happened to those black principals and black superintendents and headmasters and all that stuff? You lost a ton. You lost a generation of black talent. When you even think about Ketanji Brown Jackson's parents, I don't know what the situation was, but remember, she said they were teachers. And some of her fondest memories when she was young was seeing her dad working on his law school stuff. I just wonder why he went back to law school. Could have been because, like, you know, teaching opportunities for black folks had become sparse. I don't know.
You literally eliminated a whole entire industry. A whole entire industry was eliminated.
I can imagine that was so. And we just say, I've been to Exeter, right? It's a different level of education, true enough, but did I feel safe in any way in my own skin in Exeter? Hell no, right? I mean, you know, and some kids probably will say, yeah, I know, I feel safe. Congratulations, great for them. For me, hell no. So would a boarding school with the same level of academic rigor that was run by folks that looked like me have done me probably much? Absolutely. But we didn't have that many options laying around, and we don't pool our money. If me and you said today, okay, put out the word, we're going to open, and me, you know, we already got the plans for it.
Yeah.
We just need the funding.
It's on my show.
If somebody came to me and you today and said, we're going to hand you a $100 million check McKinsey, what's her name?
McKinsey Consulting? McKinsey and them? Who are you talking
about? Jeff Bezos' ex-wife.
McKenzie. Yeah, his wife. Yeah.
She got.
If you're listening, ma'am, like you've been giving out a lot of money. Here are two qualified educators.
$100 million, and I want to build a fantastic and beautiful black boarding school on beautiful grounds and all of that. And we would need ongoing support. And I will take kids that we have counted out. We have said won't be anything, won't amount to anything, won't contribute. And I will ensure that they are absolute excellent contributors, excellent fathers and mothers if need be, to their children, leaders. It's not rocket science. It starts with love, but it also starts with having the space and a space where you can be yourself. They won't be in Oxfords and brogues and shirts and ties every day. They'll wear shirts.
But you said this. You said this. A safe space. You said, did you feel safe in your skin? They have to be able to feel safe in their skin. You know, and that's the one thing. We throw children into spaces and we tell them, you can't do this. You know, so you have to shut down everything that you are to be something else. And that doesn't work. You know, but everything you're saying, 100%. And I know right now there are parents out there who don't know what to do with their kids. And they're just praying for that.
Yeah, Robert Smith, somebody give us $100 million and let us go to work. I promise you, we've turned around schools that were dire. We took on challenges in the Bronx, in Brooklyn, the Mississippi Delta, in Memphis, and Baltimore, and
Las Vegas.
I had peanuts for resources. So I just say, you know, building a space where the childhood of black kids is Dr. I think Derek Nelson, I forget where he's at. He was at UPenn or Swarthmore or something, but like where black childhood can be imagined and is imaginable would be revolutionary for those children. You can imagine me being a child, right? And I can be myself, my whole full quirky self, or my whole full, I don't have to be afraid to speak out. It can be done. It's not rocket science. But it does require significant resources. And I'm sorry, none of the remaining black boarding schools, they don't have the resources that Exeter has. Choate, Andover, Groton, they don't have those resources. Come on, man. If we had the endowments and the facilities and the budget of Exeter, Andover, just give, like, if we had all of that.
And it's funny, how big what's the population of Andover, Exeter, or even like Deerfield Academy?
I don't know, maybe, 1,000, 2,000 students, maybe. Some of them lost 500.
I was watching a video this summer about boarding schools around the priciest, the, you know, most reputable boarding schools. And we're talking about schools that have 8-to-1 teacher to student ratio. Some of the schools have 4-to-1. The tuitions are $80,000 a year. You know, in Switzerland, there's a school that I think the tuition is pushing 90,000. It's probably over. That list was from like 3 years ago. So that's probably over $100,000 now. In the summer, they are one campus. In the winter, they are another campus. They have a winter campus and a summer campus. The winter campus, they're skiing. they go to their winter campus where they're skiing. They're snowboarding. And then they spend time traveling around Europe and North Africa and Asia. And this is part of their education.
I took marine biology in Exeter. And we took buses and had class on the beach and collected live specimen and looked at specimen. This is the difference between a female lobster and a male lobster. And you have to throw these back. And we talked about it not being the right season. And even if it's in season, this is what a pregnant female may look like. And that, but I took animal behavior. They had an animal behavior lab with Komodo dragons and baby alligators in the lab.
I took problem solving with cow.
It was five of us in the class.
Five.
The teacher didn't need to break you into groups of five and then go around the class. It was five of us in the class problem solving pre-cow.
So how did you how did you guys sit in the classroom? Could you just share with us how was the seating arrangement in that class?
Oh, we were kind of in a circle, almost circular U. Right?
You know?
And then
very Socratic.
Yeah. Now when we took kids from Baltimore over to the UK and toured schools, we also went to Eden College. Eden College is several hundred years old, and it's where people, rulers from around the world, send their kids. That's where Prince Harry and Prince William and all of them went, and they go to school every day in kind of these long tuxedos. It's tuxedo shirts.
Like Harry Potter. They had the long coat like Harry Potter.
Yeah, but except they're like living in tuxedos. You can Google it. And, you know, it was one of the top schools. And, you know, I just wonder if, like, black folks had, like, the resources to operate a school. Like, could we get something done? And it's just, and no, I wouldn't have them in tuxedos. They might be in dashikis.
So let me share this with you real quick. So this is a developing fantasy of mine. So I went to my first 2 years of secondary school in Nigeria. I went to a military school, the Nigerian Air Force Military School in Jos in the state of Plateau, in mid central Nigeria. And it was at the time, and it's still top, one of the top schools, but back then it was the number one private, it wasn't private, but it was really government funded, but it was highly selective. It was a top school in West Africa. And everything that you said right now, this was 1987, 88. And we had our own farm. So we raised our own livestock. If you're going to talk about life cycle, we went, like we had our own animals. We had a whole entire farm, you know. So you didn't talk about photosynthesis and draw a chart. No, you went and observed it and you planted and everything else. We had engineering, all these different things. This is the 80s in Africa, you know. And it's funny because I watch movies like Wakanda and I'm like, yes, they advance everything. But that level of thinking and education exists. It's not accessible to everyone in Africa, but it is there. So imagine this. What would it look like to have that same funding that's allowed to develop a school in Africa? A boarding school where we can get kids from all of Pan-Africa, you know, to attend school there. So you can have kids from Haiti sitting with kids from Kenya, kids from South Central LA sitting with kids from Johannesburg and Soweto, and being able to sit there together and build leadership and build that capacity with the same. But the thing is this, I'm not impressed by Exeter or Andover or those schools, because we have our own schools. The only problem is it's not accessible to everyone from around the world.
Well, my two thoughts to that is that, yep, sign me. I have three thoughts. Sign me up immediately.
Mackenzie, if you're hearing this, please. You try to spend all that money, all that Bezos money.
Sign me up immediately. Because, you know, that's what the whole Rhodes Scholar is about, right? Cecil Rhodes, who plundered a lot in South Africa and down there with gold and all this stuff. He set up the whole Rhodes Scholarship because he wanted the best and brightest from around the world to be able to, especially from America, to be able to come over to Oxford and study and yada, yada, yada. And hopefully their time there would convince them to bring America back into the fold of the British Empire, yada, 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 because that was their shining jewel they lost. Ding! So for all y'all that are Rhodes Scholars, shout out Westmore, Black governor of governor-elect of Maryland. Hey.
And I met him. I had a conversation with him years ago I met with his brother and we sat and we had a conversation. Crazy.
And watch this. Shout out Larry Hogan. The governor's going out. He's a Republican, but he's somebody that ran for president. Like, y'all take a look at him because, like, he's a super moderate Republican that was a Republican in a blue state. And that means that a whole bunch of Maryland Democrats who definitely voted for him because of just being a good leader. And that's what it's about, leader. No matter leadership, whether you red or blue, but like it's about leadership and the quality of your moral compass and yada, yada, yada. But no, yeah, so sign me up immediately. That sounds extremely revolutionary. Because that would create a breeding ground for intellectual thought and discourse that can reshape the postmodern age. Exactly. So we've been in the age of Europe for the last couple hundred years, but we weren't in the age of Europe for all of time. It's only since the invention of the gun and the advancement in gun like weaponry that allowed Europeans to be, but we haven't been that way. So that will create a breeding ground that could be very dangerous. And three, I think we would be promptly assassinated. But remember, I said, sign me up first.
I hear you.
Sacrifice must be made.
No. I mean, I agree with you 100%.
That's my problem. Yeah, that's my whole problem is that too many sapsucker men, especially, don't have no sense of duty, no sense of honor, and no sense of sacrifice. No. We don't feel that we're connected to something that's bigger than us, right? And I think being able to educate people and have them appreciate who they are and have them to become global citizens with a strong sense of themselves and to not be ashamed of anything that's related to their unique cultures and overall culture, that's something that I'm willing to stand in front of the freight train for, stand in front of the tank for, or stand in front of the bulldogs for. The problem is we don't have enough people that's willing to walk across that Edmund Pettus Bridge with our dearly departed Brother Lewis these days. We got a lot of folks that will want to flip police cars and cut up when a murder happens, but if we ask them to show up and really show up and show out for what's happening in schools, killing us slowly. When Brother Malcolm called it with Dovahkiin, they put something in your mouth. So when they pulling your teeth and messing with your teeth, you suffer peacefully. You're dying slowly. So we don't have enough people that's willing to show up for that because that's the real work. All this hooping and hollering every time somebody gets shot. And truth be told, police kill more crazy white boys and they do black dudes, and truth be told, more black dudes gonna get shot in Baltimore this week than are gonna get killed by the police in all the whole country. That's the reality. And it's not equating anyone's life or whatever, but the real work is show up to do something about these schools, about this funding model. But you ain't willing to walk across that bridge. You ain't willing to get bit by that dog or to face that opposition, right? So that's my thing. But I appreciate the people that showed up and showed out and voted for that for Brother Warnock down there in Georgia, because if we had voted Herschel Walker in, I was going to Barbados. I was going to Barbados before 23 in. I would have never saw 2023 in this country. I went to Barbados.
No, listen, if he had gotten elected, I would have been like, I would 100% believe next White House. Because I'm like, if they put this brother into the Senate, then he's going to be president. Like, it's just insane. But you know, it is 11:11, so we're about 10 minutes over our time for this evening. But one thing I want to say, like you're talking about the stamina of people to, you know, when there's a shooting or there's something like that, people will come out. And what my brain was pushing me towards is that we have a lot of sprinters. We got a lot of people who want to do that sprint. They want to do that short distance, show out explosion, and then they burn out and they just keep, and they distracted something else. And the reality is we need more marathon runners. You know, we need more people in the vein of Nipsey, that, you know, that the marathon continues, because that's what it is. You know, the things that need to be corrected and fixed took centuries to undo and put us in the position we are right now. So the question is, who are the people who are willing to say, you know what, I'm going to commit time and resources to build something more? And it's funny because I am fascinated by all these other racial groups and culture and ethnic groups and cultural groups who will stand behind a belief system over generations. You know, over generations. So it's nothing new for them. You know, and my question is, when do we get to start doing the same thing? You know, because at the end of the day, like we started this conversation, we're connected. And that's the revelation. It's not that we're connecting. We were already connected. We're already at the hip. It's just that the portions of us that is connected has been covered. So we just think we're separate. We think Haitians are just Haitians, Jamaicans are Jamaicans, those from the South in America are just from the South, those from the North, Chicago, whatever, Lagos, we're just these different groups, but we're all the same. The question is, when do we all, and that's the thing too, because I know as you're speaking, I'm envisioning the conversation here in America, but it's the same thing in Nigeria. There's people in Nigeria who have the mentality where it's like, you know, we'll show out for the little things, but the real work that requires that we all, bro, let me tell you another fantasy. I would love to attend like that vision that Malcolm had, that, you know, that OAU, was it the OAU? The Organization of African Unity or whatever it was. Yep, like, I would love to see that, where we all come together and we say, okay, let's talk about this. What are we going to do? Delegates from Haiti, delegates from America, from Brazil. What are we going to do? What are we going to commit resources to? Because those kinds of schools can happen. The money is out there in these nations, in these spaces, and to make these things happen. But the question is, who has the guts to actually say, let's commit the resources? And I'm in 100%. I'll move my whole entire family to wherever it is. But the question is, who has the resources? Who's willing to commit to Pan-Africanism and the revolution of education? Because it's not picking up guns and shooting each other. It's picking up books and pencils and laptops and actually doing a deeper dive into what the truth is. But that's what I got to say for this evening.
I'm with you. Before we break out, I do have to tell you, I did cop those DJ Khaled Jordans that came out. Ooh.
You got those?
Ooh, wait. I'm going to hurt them. I'm going to hurt them when I'm out there. If y'all see me out there, I didn't bring them on camera because I'm going to hurt them on it.
Hold on.
I do have my eye on them ones you showed me. You know, the patent leather. When you showed them to me, I got my eye on them. As you know, I have a problem. We all Ivy League hood rats, so you know, leave us alone. This means stuff to us.
Yes. Yeah, focus on there.
Watch it. Oh yeah.
So, these are the 12 taxis.
Oh, okay, okay.
I'm not sure when I'm gonna bust these out, but I've never owned a pair of 12s before. You know, I never did the flu games and stuff like that. But yeah, these, and then I got another pair still in the box that I got like a couple of days ago. It's still in the box. Those 11s. Listen, those 11s did something to me. I haven't bought a pair in almost a year. Those 11s, when I had this pound leather joints, I was like,
I'm going to go for the overlay. They sent them to you pre-order there because you're a special customer. I got to stand in line. I got to not stand in line, but I got to try and bid for them. But I'm going to get those. Yes, sir.
Bro, I'll be doing the same thing. Once in a while, I get lucky. But the other thing, too, is my main connect, he's no longer in the sneaker game. So I was like, ugh, so I got to find a new connect. But yeah.
All right, brother. Y'all be safe. You know, be well out there. You know, watch your back, watch each other's back. You know, enjoy your privileges as much as you can. Yeah, enjoy your privileges as much as you can. Be safe, be well. Until we come together again.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much again for this evening. Do me a favor. Lee Wins, I gotta shout you out because you are a faithful listener, participant. Respect to you. Flags represent us for show. Do me a favor. If you're watching this live or you're watching a re-recording of this, do me a favor. Share the link of what you're watching from. Let's get this out there. We are on here every Wednesday at 10 p.m. And we're just talking. We're talking. Sometimes we're laughing and we're just having a conversation, but we eventually get into heavier things. You know, we have a lot of things going on in our community that we need to discuss, and I'm hoping this is a platform to get you thinking. I appreciate y'all. My brother Archie, love you. You're the man. You know, you always get me thinking, and now I'm going to go and read something so I can catch up with you for next week. Appreciate you, bro. And Brother Solomon, same to you. Thank you again. Good luck with that thing, that thing we talked about. Good luck with that thing, all right? Let me know how I can help you. And with that being said, have an amazing night, everybody. Peace. Until next time.
And now he's been promoted. His job, principal.
This hustle, baby, hustle, but then what?